This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 22nd of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 333 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be looking at video game culture and finding out just how little we know about it with Darren Wall, a publisher who has a smart new take on the industry's less storied pioneers.
Then we'll be taking a trip to Iran with filmmaker Tom Allen, who, along with pal Leon McCarron, decided to travel through the nation along the path of the country's longest river, the Karun. He'll be here to discuss their film of the very same name.
And we'll meet Paola Zuccotti, the Argentinian-Italian talent who's photographing the objects we use every day and asking what it is that they say about us.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henri Rhys Sheridan will be putting a loose bet on what will be making the headlines next week in the news look ahead, and we'll play some music here too on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We've already had a laugh.
Exactly, that was funny.
Someone else's expense.
Who's this Henri Rhys Sheridan he's knocking about?
Well, we should say that Henry, or known now as Henri, is going to be joining us because this week Kim, who's French and works for us in the building, she happened to hear his name on a list and she kind of begins to Frenchify people as she goes around the building, and she listed him as Henri Rhys Sheridan,
I think he wears it well.
Yeah, I think he can roll with
it. It's that Breton jersey he's always wearing. The other thing you stressed, Andrew, in the intro there, was that it's edition 333 of the Monocle Weekly.
You said this has got something to do with albatrosses.
Well, yeah, this is a sort of quirky English. It's if you do crosswords, you'll know about albatrosses and cricket scores and all that kind of thing.
I know nothing about cricket scores.
It's supposedly bad luck, sort of 111, 222, 333. So let's hope we buck that ill luck trend on today's programme.
We will do. We should just say a little word, I think, before we move on. We're going to be our usual rude, irreverent selves today. But let's just say a quick note that last week, I think people tuning in, they will have heard that a special show I did with Tyler and Steve popped in as well. Obviously, in the wake of the Paris attacks, we felt crucial to do something that was live. And we marked the moment. Across lots of Monocle 24, we've been solemn and we've marked the moment, and of course it remains a top of mind, but I think today we all feel that it's time for a little bit of a return to normal here on Monocle 24, a little bit of a joviality too. And that's why we're bringing Henri in just a moment. Henri, oh Henri,
Henry's theme. Henri's theme, perhaps I should say.
I can't believe that you're bringing me into lighting things up. I thought I was a serious news guy in the building.
It always begins.
I'm aiming for a Pulitzer here, guys.
we've been on the road quite a bit lately, and someone actually just said to me the other day, "You're not very nice to that Danny Giacopelli." We're very nice at Danny Giacopelli. We do have a nice laugh.
It's all friendly, Henry. That's how it works.
Well,
how are you doing now, anyway?
Henry the cat.
That was one of the words in your jingle. How are you doing now?
I'm doing fine. Thanks very much for asking.
Well, that's good.
I appreciate it.
That's as polite as it's going to be.
Yeah, okay. It's just going to go downhill from there in terms of etiquette.
Probably.
Okay, where are you going to begin?
We're going to a lot of world events this week still bear the marks of the attacks in France. A lot of the serious stuff that's going on. And probably the most significant diplomatic meetings are those of François Hollande, who is meeting up with both Obama on Tuesday the 24th, then 2 days after that with Vladimir Putin, going to Washington and Moscow respectively to do that. Now, he wants to encourage, in his own words, a large coalition between the two countries in order to combat ISIS more effectively. Obviously, given increased geopolitical tensions this year between particularly Russia and the West in general, this is a big sea change that we're potentially looking at.
Well, it would have been the most unlikely alliance even just a few weeks ago probably, but it seems now it's weirdly the sort of rehabilitation almost of Putin continues.
I know, interesting. Yeah, obviously, France traditionally, you know, even during the period of the Cold War, had kind of better relationships because it sat outside of NATO with Russia. It's always been a reasonably good conduit to Moscow. And maybe that they're not going to be bedfellows for a very long time, but that suddenly there is a large number of world leaders. I see even China lost somebody in the Paris attacks. There's a large number of world leaders who are all focused on the very same objective now. Mm. So, you know, as we say, maybe your enemy is my enemy, but suddenly there's something could happen there.
Which is, yeah, obviously, I'm kind of optimistic. There are already investors betting that sanctions against Ukraine are going to be scaled back. So there seems to be concrete evidence for optimism. Hopefully something constructive will come for it. Moving on, another event in France, Friday the 27th, they're going to host the COP21 climate talks. It'll be interesting to see how these go. Public demonstrations have very unfortunately been banned by the French police. You can't guarantee public safety. And I think it's an interesting example of how, you know, these attacks have impacted on politics and democratic debates as usual in, you know, target Western democracies.
And I think that also some of the events that would have surrounded the climate talks are kind of being scaled back or cancelled as well. They're going to keep it much leaner, the whole kind of process. And it's fair enough when your forces, I guess, are stretched with so many other things. It's not ideal kind of anything that seems to curtail the democratic process. But in the end, if you're focused on a manhunt or if you're focused on stopping other terrorist attacks, it doesn't seem to be the worst loss at this point.
Mm. And today, Sunday the 22nd, Mutti is 10. Angela Merkel celebrates 10 years in office. And what a 10-year it's been, particularly this year. I'm not sure, Tom, you want to go over some of the main events that she's faced. I thought I'd bring you in. You've been quiet for a while.
No,
I've got a list here.
No, do you know what? I was just pondering that. That's a pretty extraordinary decade.
I like Henri. He's good.
He turns the tables.
He's like going to pull a little rug from underneath your feet.
Well, no, I think one thing that's interesting about Angela Merkel is, you know, all across Europe, we're talking about, you know, whether it's the recent events in Paris or the migration crisis, and a lot of cynical politicians, populists in particular, trying to draw these strands together and make political capital out of it. And I think one of Merkel's great triumphs of the last 12 months, certainly, is to have ridden out the storm of a lot of these pressures with quite a good deal of decorum, with some class. And it's a measure, I guess, of how much she's become a fixture, not just for Germany, but for Europe over the last 10 years, that she just, you know, she seems like, I don't know, she just seems like a sort of a real European figurehead. She seems so stable politically.
This is the thing. I mean, even looking in the last year, you've had, you know, the recent attacks, you've had Greece, you've had the refugee crisis, you've had the German wings crash. That's in the last year. There's been much more before that. And in all of these instances, you might not agree with what she's done, but she has led. She has led in a way that actually many other European leaders can't be said to have done. So I think she's an admirable leader. Certainly.
And the other amazing thing is because you're obviously, for simple reasons, Germany can never be seen to have a charismatic leader, really. So there's always a technocrat who's kind of in that position as chancellor. And yet, as you're right, she's the leader of Europe. For somebody who doesn't do personality politics in a big way, who keeps her family out of the limelight, who kind of just gets on with the methodical nature of government. But despite all that, she's seen as this kind of, you know, leader for the whole of Europe.
And also today, Sunday the 22nd, there's going to be the runoff elections to decide the presidency of Argentina. Mauricio Macri is going to be running against Daniel Scioli. Macri is the Peronist candidate favoured by Kirchner.
It'd be great if they actually did have to have a runoff, literally running. Okay, on your marks.
I fully endorse this. We should do it.
Who would you bet on in that instance?
In that race?
Yeah.
I don't know. If it was a foot race, I'm not sure who's in the best shape, to be honest.
I know that, was it, Scioli used to be a professional powerboat racer.
Oh,
do you know this?
He's got to be in the box seat then, if it came to a physical encounter.
No,
you've got to be in quite good shape. I need to control, because there's lots of G-force.
Okay.
You've got to reach a minimal threshold of fitness, but I'm not sure, you know.
I would imagine your
legs are kind of, I'm not going to speculate about what position you're kept as a powerboat racer. But anyway, the endorsement of Sergio Massa, who was the third candidate who was defeated in the initial round, might come to be important. He's a Peronist, Scioli, but he's a dissident Peronist, and he's quite a vocal critic of the Kirchner government, so it all should be very interesting.
And what are his running shoes like?
I don't know what his running shoes are like. I do wonder about that.
Okay. Because Cristina, she wouldn't have done so well, because you always had on a high heel. She liked a high heel. Actually, maybe she should have taken them off for the run. off.
I would have hoped so.
She could have lobbed a stiletto in like the in her rival's back.
Don't encourage using it as a weapon. No. She would have been so far behind, she would have had to throw it forward, is that what you're suggesting?
Possibly.
I think she would have done well, personally, if she'd removed, you know...
Are you going to come out of the world of politics, or is that your thing?
Come out of the world of politics.
Yeah, you've got anything more entertaining than that?
Well, no, I thought, you know, we'd keep it, you know, kind of... I know we're segueing into a kind of, you know, lighter mood, but I thought we'd keep it relatively kind of, you know...
We like a bit of cheese rolling at the end.
I did Surfing Dogs the first week, but you weren't there.
Okay.
Maybe, you know, next time. I'm sorry. I've disappointed you.
Henri, très bien, très bien. Merci.
Merci bien.
Au revoir. Now, you don't really hear us talking about gadgets, tech, and certainly not video games too often here on the Monocle Weekly, and that's not because we don't like them. It's more that Andrew and I's recreational time is often spent entranced by more simple pleasures. A spinning top, perhaps, Andrew, or any number of Victorian parlour games
that
have stood the test of time.
But that's all set to change. Well, it's not rubbish. I do know very little about this topic. But anyway, today we're going to welcome Darren Wall, who's the designer, even, and editor-in-chief of publishing imprint Read Only Memory. He's here to talk about Britsoft and Oral History, which is telling the story of the UK's fledgling games industry in the 1970s and 80s, one that was thrashed out on long-dead formats such as the ZX Spectrum and the Commodore 64. Oh, you remember those, Tom. Now, Darren created it with editor Alex Wiltshire and with the London design agency Julia, who also oversee the sharp look of institutions here in the UK, such as the ICA.
And Darren joins us now to talk through this, well, is it a lost chapter of the technological revolution? Darren, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
I guess that's a good starting point then. Is it a bit of a lost history? I mean, is this a book that's for, you know, aficionados of the ZX Spectrum, the Commodore 64, or is it actually something that, you know, is for... I don't want to say Luddite, Andrew, but people who are less au fait with some of these areas. What's the purpose of it, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, really. I started Read Only Memory as a way to publish books about video games that weren't specifically aimed at people who were obsessive about games. I think there's a lot of kind of interesting cultural stories around the creation of games, just as there are around the creation of a great album or a movie. And I wanted to present these stories and these kind of documentary histories in a way that kind of felt like an art book, like a kind of architectural art book or something like that. So in terms of Britsoft, it was a movement that kind of went undetected, I feel. So it started in the late 70s and went through to the mid-90s when the industry was kind of swamped with Japanese consoles and everybody was kind of priced out. But there were all these kind of personalities, all of these stories about British entrepreneurial spirit that have been largely untold. And it follows a progression throughout that decade, throughout the 80s, where you can definitely see a rise and fall, personalities arise and things like that. And I feel like it's never been gathered together before, so that was kind of the purpose of the book.
There's a tagline on the front of the book, which we should say says, from bedrooms to billions. And we should also just point out that it's a thick, beautiful book, hardback cover. And I think if anybody who's in that kind of world of thinking they're going to crack it open and see lots of pictures of consoles and old games and screen grabs, whatever, that isn't your kind of beat at all. You've produced something which is mainly text-led,
that's right.
Really kind of individual narratives. It's interesting, I guess, it's one of those sectors where there's so much money involved, but there's very little high-end publishing. How come you felt that there was this kind of niche for you to kind of get in? Well, it shouldn't be a niche. Why did you feel this was good territory for you?
I felt like you described exactly what kind of led me to launch Read Only Memory. It was kind of like a desire to, you know, I wander around gallery bookshops and often buy books purely because of the design of the book and kind of like very seduced by that high-end publishing model. And there just wasn't anything I felt for people who wanted to read about video game history. There's lots of, as you say, screenshot-filled magazines and sort of books that are kind of nostalgic, but there was nothing of kind of academic weight or kind of cultural weight. So that's kind of our approach with this one.
When you look back, what's interesting, I guess, in this whole field, there are many people who started off then who then did go on to make billions or did go on to make millions, who set up companies, who found franchises, who, you know, were quick at changing with the technology. But when you went back to meet all these people, how many of them have kind of maintained a link within that world? And how many of them were kind of early adopters who, you know, haven't taken out a games console in kind of a decade or more?
So there's a real sort of rich variety of those kind of different types of personalities. For instance, there's in the book we've got Jeff Minter, who is basically a kind of industry legend. He has a farm and he keeps his own sheep, which he kind of feeds every day on Periscope. You can watch that. And he makes games largely about llamas. And he has remained independent since the early 80s. And then we've got people like David Braben and Peter Molyneux, who are both OBEs. and have kind of like risen to very high positions in the industry. And then we have people who've left the industry and were burned by the sort of the mid-90s revolution and have completely left it as well. So there's a real nice mix of people who have sort of sailed that wave and kind of reached success. And there's people who have almost been chewed up and spit out as well. So there's kind of a lot of mixed emotions in there, which we tried to kind of weave together in a way that's interesting.
Darren, you mentioned Jeff Minter there, and there's a quote, there's a longer quote, but I'll read a bit of it, which is from Jeff, I think, talking about what the market was like in the early days and how there were a few, you know, cowboys and cavaliers involved. He said, there's a new market that was desperate for software and people were selling any old crap, to be honest, but I was very fortunate. Was that true in the early days? Was it really a question of people just, you know, they didn't really understand what this sector was, and it supported, in his words,
any old crap.
Was that really the story? Is that echoed by other people?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there was a bit of a gold rush. WH Smith comes up in it a lot, a British institution, and they were the primary place where you could buy video games, and there were huge amounts of games going into WH Smith and being sold every week. And the book also charts the rise of the British journalism industry, games journalism, and there wasn't a way to find out if anything was good, but there was a huge hunger to buy games, so therefore a lot of very quickly made crap was made. And obviously the video game sort of journalism industry rose in order to kind of sift through that. The magazines are actually populated by people who were like 16, 17, 18, who were gamers and became extremely kind of passionate and discerning gamers, because they would go and spend their pocket money or go and spend their sort of earned money on a game, and it would provide them with no entertainment value whatsoever.
So tell me, you know, I'm not going to guess your age, because then people could start guessing mine. I never liked that game.
Let's not play that.
But I presume that you're not somebody who was around playing games in the early 70s. So when you looked at this group of people and looked at this bit of history, it's like somebody who's, you know, now in their 20s, whatever, writing about the Beatles. What drew you back to this period? Why did you find these figures so, you know, intriguing?
I think I caught it at the tail end, which was the book kind of charts the decline of Britsoft, which was in the early 90s. Japanese consoles came in, and a lot of these computers were like £500 to buy, and they were marketed as business machines. Everyone would get them home, unwrap them, sort of do their accounts for, you know, 5 minutes, and then go, should we buy some games? And that's kind of how it came about. And they were also the machines that you could make the games on. So that's where that kind of like sort of British entrepreneurial spirit kicked in. And I remember as a kid having a Commodore 64 and an Amiga. I'd spend my time half playing games and half kind of tinkering around and creating. And then as soon as consoles came in, which were £100, £200 in the early 90s, it was just a much more kind of discerning choice to spend your money on that and play these high-quality games.
So in the early days, what's an example of a game that did take off and was popular and, you know, that was made by these people? When you look back at some of those classic games, is there one that sticks in your mind as a good example from this period?
I think one that stands out for a lot of people as being way ahead of its time is Elite, which was on the BBC Micro. And I think a lot of people's first experience of seeing that game was, you know, something quite staggering, because it was 3D on an 8-bit console. And it was basically Star Wars. It was basically kind of you were a space explorer and you could do whatever you wanted. We talk a lot about open world gaming at the moment and the possibilities of being kind of fully united online and exploring infinite worlds. That was a game that shared all of those tropes and was actually released in the early 80s for an 8-bit console. So I think that vision, which came out of two guys working together in Cambridge, just tinkering away, making the game and then trying to sell it, I think that kind of like really embodies that kind of Britsoft spirit. It was very, very fearless.
People often talk about that and they say, actually, when there are privations, when you're starved of options, your resources are limited, you become necessarily more creative. Do you think that, I mean, it strikes me maybe you're a bit of a sort of a purist when it comes to video games, but was this the best time precisely for that reason? It meant people had to think more laterally. They had to be more creative with these limited resources. Now, everything's, you know, multi-million dollar. The new games now, they have budgets like Hollywood movies. Has the gaming world lost something because of the end of that innocence, the end of that, I don't know, that, yeah, like I said, a couple of guys in a bedroom, you know, tinkering away. Oh, that sounds a bit weird, but you know what I mean.
I think we've seen a resurgence of that with mobile gaming and indie gaming as well recently, where a small team, even one person, can create a game that can be a worldwide hit. We have creators like Mike Bithell in this country who make fantastic games that are recognised globally, and he's just one guy. So I think that was something that was completely absent in the industry up until relatively recently. And I think we were seeing a resurgence of that. We recently put together with Game City in Nottingham a conference related to Britsoft, and we had a lot of new developers there, and there was a lot of agreement that we were seeing a resurgence of that spirit and that those kind of possibilities, because the barrier to entry to making games now is a lot less than it was. You know, anyone can pick up a Mac or a PC and actually get starting to make games with things like Game Maker or Unity. So I think that spirit was always there, and now again the barrier to entry has been lowered. So I think now is the most exciting time for video games. I think going back to play a lot of these games, you know, some have dated very poorly and some are sort of still fantastic and still inspirational. So I think it's more about that kind of outlook in making games than it is about the games themselves.
Can I just pick up one thing that both of you touched on there? You know, Tom said these guys, these guys in their bedroom. You said now anyone can make a game. But of course, when you look through the people you've interviewed here, you know, because it was reality, there is I haven't spotted a woman's name yet. So a small group of like-minded guys, boys making games, has that anyone become anyone, or is it just actually one or two more women attached to this group of guys doing the same kind of thing? I know it's been a big debate in the world of computer games because of the kind of, you know, the trolling of women who have kind of entered the games field. What's your kind of little social take on all of that?
It's something we were really conscious on, and this is the third book we've done now, and it seems to be a common thread that it is. And we sort of, to paraphrase our introduction to the book, it's a peculiarly male-dominated industry. And it's something that we're conscious of as historians, if we go about making our books in that way, that we represent it as best we can. We do have one female voice in the book, is Mo Warden, who is an artist. And I remember being in touch with her about being in the book and mentioning the fact that we did want to provide as much balance as possible. But certainly in the 70s and 80s, it was almost entirely male dominated, and the reasons for that I'm not sure. I think it's something that it was very peculiar to the time, and I think having sort of been to the conference we've been to recently, we were refreshed to see that lots of young developers, it's much more egalitarian now, it's much more sort of evenly spread between male and females, but back then it did seem to be almost entirely male. And it's something that when editing books in the past, I've had a real kind of issue with, that we're putting all these books together and we'll sort of look at the
You can't change history, but do you think that if somebody in your position in 30 years time does a book about the history of the games industry looking back, there'll be five women's names in the index? Or do you think it would be actually getting towards parity at some point? It seems unlikely to me. It seems that there is something about this world which is peculiarly kind of male. And not being funny, I guess most of the names, I look at their surnames, they must be English white boys sitting in, you know, suburbia in their bedrooms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually that comes up quite early on. The price of the machines that you could develop on were sort of £400-£500 back in the early 80s. So there is a lot of, you know, kind of young men who lived in Cambridge, and that seems to be a theme. And then sort of tracing it back, you realise that it was a particularly sort of middle class activity in order to have a computer in the home, and it grew out of that. So hopefully, as I was saying, with the kind of barrier to entry being lowered now, we'll see more change. And you mentioned, I believe you were sort of relating to Gamergate, which happened recently, which was kind of the sort of particularly unpleasant thing that happened. And I think now that's the kind of growing pains of the industry, and I hope we're going to see change, and I hope that's going to be something that improves.
I'm sure it happened in the music industry and all sorts of other industries too.
It's an incredible history, and it's documented in fine style in the book Britsoft, an oral history published by Read Only Memory. And Darren Wall, editor-in-chief of Read Only Memory, thanks very much for coming to tell us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Andrew, time for music. You ready?
I'm ready.
Let's hear a new collaboration between pop singer Maya Hawthorne, producer Jack Splash, and smooth 70s crooner Bobby Caldwell. It's Cool Uncle with, suitably enough, given what we were just talking about, Game Over.
That was Cool Uncle with Game Over. You listen to the Monocle Weekly.
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With All Press coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
Tom Allen and Leon McCarron are two friends who in 2014 decided they wanted to see the world, and a very specific part of it, Iran. Tom and Leon captured the journey in a new film, Karoon, which documents their trip following the route of Iran's longest river of the same name.
Recently, Iran hasn't always flung open the doors for visitors, but it now stands at a bit of a crossroads, with Iranian society becoming ever more open, thanks to gradually improving relations with the West after a recent agreement on the future of its atomic industry. But that diplomatic subtext was still unfolding when Tom and Leon touched down in the country, ready to explore the nation by foot, bike, kayak, and many more options too. And Tom met Tom, as it were, to discuss it all a little bit earlier on.
This is just about one of the most beautiful landscapes I've ever walked through, and I don't say that lightly. This is absolutely stunning.
I'm trying to see this country from another perspective, and this is proving to be a fantastic way of doing that.
This is a place which I think a lot of the Western world is quite afraid of, but when you get here, it's just the warmest, friendliest country you could imagine.
Tom Allen, one of the adventurers we heard from then, and hearing that clip from your film, how important is that? That word there, it's, it kind of crops up throughout the piece about, you know, looking at things from a different perspective, and not metaphorically in some cases, but quite literally. Was that always the intent behind the film? And was that always in your mind as you went through the adventures that were unfolding, to keep that different perspective coming?
Definitely. I think we designed the whole trip to offer that different perspective. And so we did it in various different ways. We were walking, we were cycling, we were kayaking, you know, doing quite an unusual journey. And it was all focused on this idea of getting maximum variety out of the journey and out of the experiences.
Now, I wonder, I mean, people who see the film will quickly realise this for themselves, how many times exactly, and you articulate it sometimes in the film, that you thought, actually, this was a terrible idea. Because you mentioned those methods of transport fraught with problems, inconveniences, real dangers. How many times did you admonish yourself, you and Leon both, and think, oh my God, what on earth are we thinking?
I think I lost count.
Too many to count.
We did set out on quite a challenging journey. We knew that. You know, neither of us have done much paddling in the past. We totally underestimated the climate when we began. Up in the mountains, it was minus 15 on the first night, and there I was in a pair of trainers.
I mean, I was going to ask you about this, because they say, you know, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. It was pretty amazing that you're holy, spelled with an E, trainers. I don't know, how did that happen? Was it just that you had this image of, you know, these balmy nights, or what? Why did you manage to get that wrong?
Well, you know, to be honest, I think we were guilty of the same kind of preconception of Iran that I think a lot of people have, which is that it's generally a hot and dry place. Mm. And we just didn't expect that there'd be that much snow up in the mountains, especially in the south of Iran. You know, that's kind of on the same level as kind of Mexico. So you think it's going to be warm. So, you know, my mistake, really.
Yeah.
There you go.
And it's interesting, I'm talking about your failure to prepare. You've prepared very thoroughly in other respects, including learning Farsi. And I know you have sort of family connections to the region as well. But was that a challenge, or does all those things pay off when you get there and you're able to engage with people? Because people, again, are front and centre in this piece, aren't they? And was the language, having some mastery of that, was that really important?
It was, and I'd spent a good couple of years before the trip learning. Like you just mentioned, I do have some connections with Iran, and specifically my wife is from Iran and fluent in Farsi, and it's through her that I've got the experience of Iran that I had before this journey, although it was very much restricted to the cities. So I knew from previous experiences that with the language, you get so much more depth of an experience, and you get on the side with people a lot more quickly as well. Although in Iran, you're going to be on the side as soon as you turn up, because it's that kind of place.
This is the amazing thing. I mean, people joke about well, it's no joke, but there's the cliche of the kindness of strangers, and people always talk about that warmth in Iran. And the film constantly documents, and you guys actually mentioned that it's good that it's filmed because you can see how amazingly welcoming these people are. Even given your expectations, did it surprise you? To the extent to which people wanted to, you know, drive you places or welcome you to their homes and this sort of thing.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was delightfully surprising. We were hoping that was what's going to happen, but I don't think either of us really were prepared for the extent to which we would be just sucked into the country by the people. And for example, we took all our camping gear because this was going to be quite a wilderness journey for 6 weeks. We used it on the first night, and that was the last time we ever had to camp, because every other night we were out on the road, we would be welcomed into someone's home.
And it's funny, I mean, the help comes from all sorts of quarters. We've got another little clip which we'll just listen to now. We'll hear from you afterwards. Let's take a listen. This was another example of the kindness of strangers.
We were just about to buy some bicycles for like 100 two-man, 20 quid.
And then without like any kind of correlation to anything whatsoever, we met a bloke in a tiny little watch shop who's just offered to give us 2 bikes for our trip, as long as we give them back in the same condition. This guy we've just met on the street. I don't even know what his name is. That's why I love this part of the world, because you never know what's going to happen. And sometimes it's bad and sometimes it's brilliant. This is one of the brilliant examples.
Now, Tom, it's a great moment in the film, but you do allude there to the fact that, you know, it's not all good. And there were moments of tension, not because you were being chased by wolves or tumbling down a river, but because of, you know, the more, I guess, the problems with the state, with the authorities, with the police. They crop up pretty frequently too. Again, how did that marry up with what your expectations were before the trip?
I think I was slightly naive. I want to say up front that I don't think our experience in that sense would reflect any kind of normal tourist experience whatsoever. Mm. Purely the fact that we were really putting ourselves out into very remote places, doing an unusual kind of journey, and we were carrying a video camera to try and document that. That all kind of put us on the radar a little bit. And so we did find that people, the local authorities, did want to know what we were doing. And so they would stop us, they were questioners. Inevitably, we would explain ourselves. They'd realise we were just tourists with a video camera and let us go. But that was quite a regular thing that happened.
Do you think that, you know, there's people who say, you know, it's such a great country to discover. And I think people seeing this film, despite those attendant risks, will probably be encouraged to go and try for themselves. Do you think that's a good thing? It, you know, if we see more people going, will it start to maybe break down some of those barriers? Will it start to ease maybe suspicions? Or do you think there's still, you know, such a long way to go?
Well, it's an interesting time for all this to be happening, because obviously with political relations thawing at the moment, people are starting to ask that question. You know, we've heard about Iran, but what actually is it like on the ground? And I'm hoping this film is going to show people a bit of a picture of that. And, you know, I'm personally invested in, I would like more people to go there and see for themselves the difference between the people and the government, which is a bit of a cliche, but it's so true in Iran. And I know that the Iranian people really want to shed this image that they've got in the international press. And part of the motivation for making this film was to try and give them a bit of a voice and show people, you know, a more nuanced picture.
And one of the things I think that helps to show that in the film is where when you and Leon reflect on some of the history. And that gives it a really interesting different perspective, because you see that it's not quite as simple as, you know, Western friendly, Western unfriendly. Let's take another little listen to another clip. This is where you and Leon are sort of down in the gas fields area talking about some of those complexities. Let's take a listen.
And what's interesting is that last night when we were staying in the village back up there, the old guy told us that the village had been built by the British probably 80 or 90 years ago, when there were gas and oil prospectors in Iran, and when Britain and Iran were essentially friends and allies. And then history unfolded as it did. The oil and gas was, I suppose, returned to its natural, to its rightful owners, and the British were expelled fairly briskly. Well, no one seems to have a problem with us at all. Even when we basically got helped out by the police a couple of days ago and got taken up to the police station to have our passports checked and all the rest of it, the police chief was like, yeah, the British used to live and work here, Americans used to live and work here. The reason we didn't film any of these interactions is because the last thing we want to be perceived as is British journalists without permission making a documentary about sensitive things in Iran, and this is the crux of the matter regarding the relationship between the UK and Iran. It's the natural resources. We're right in the middle of it. And to get a camera out and start asking pertinent questions, you know, even this little camera, I mean, it's not worth the risk.
And Tom, it's interesting that that sort of historical perspective, it actually goes back a lot further. It's not just the last 90 years. It goes back, and you talk about this in the film a couple of times, maybe thousands of years. There's a town you visit where there's the dams and all this incredible technology that was built by Roman prisoners, and then it was added to by the Brits like hundreds or thousands of years later. Again, do you think people are maybe, they fail to appreciate, you know, all of these different inputs and the fact that that is what's shaping modern Iran as much as anything else?
I think so, but there's this strange dichotomy. There's Iran, and people associate that word Iran with the current political situation. But then if you say Persia, which is the old-fashioned name for Iran, there's a whole different image comes to mind of this ancient civilization. And obviously Iran today is both of those things. And the heritage is something that the Iranian people hold very, very dear. You know, it's very close to their hearts. They're very proud of that aspect of their country. And for most people who want to go and visit Iran, those historical places are going to be right at the top of their list of destinations. And in that sense, Iran is just a gold mine. It's a stunning place.
Well, and it certainly looks stunning in the film. Tell me a bit about looking back on the whole trip in totality, especially from the relative safety of Yerevan or here in London. What do you think about, I don't know, tackling these things again? Because you mentioned quite a few times yourself and Leon, that this, you know, being these hapless adventurers, these hapless travellers. Did it pique your interest? Would you try something even more madcap than this next time in Iran or, I don't know, somewhere else that you could think of? is that definitely a no?
I don't know. I like the adventures for the sake of it. And I've got an eye out for the next one, for sure. And filmmaking for me is kind of my craft and it's what I do. As for what might be next, I really don't know. But Iran's definitely not, it's not in the past. My wife will always be Iranian and I always have family there, so I'll keep going back. And I'd like to see more stories like this coming out of it.
Tell me about what you think this film could do, in its own modest way. Do you think that, I don't know, would you get a different welcome? Do you hope that some people within Iran, obviously the people you encountered, might be able to see the film and reflect on it? What do you think it... I don't know, if some of those people who we see in the film saw it, what do you think they'd make of it?
I guess my main friend in Iran, who's featured in the film quite a lot, he's seen it and he's very happy with the way it portrays Iran. He's very unhappy with his level of English at that point in time. And the other chaps who we got the bikes from, they're going to get a copy of it quite soon once it's translated into Farsi. I have no idea what they'll make of it. They'll probably find it quite amusing. But we've put it out to a community of travellers and Iranians who we know already. And a lot of people seem to think that it's just a really nice story, a positive story coming out of Iran, essentially, something that paints it in a more positive light. And we hope that that will be the legacy of it, in, as you said, in its own modest way. It's a small project, but that's what we'd like to happen.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with it. And it was certainly great to watch. And it's been great to talk to you and hear all about it, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming to see us.
That was Tom Edwards talking to Tom Allen a little bit earlier on. And Karun will be available from karunfilm.com. That's karunfilm.com from Monday. Go enjoy.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Paola Zuccotti is an Argentinian-Italian creative whose work looks at fields ranging from ethnography to branding. Her latest project is a book called Everything We Touch. Across its pages, Zuccotti has photographed objects we use in the space of just one day and by people around the globe, and all from very different walks of life too.
The objects, separated from their owners, act as both a poignant and occasionally amusing study in humans' very tactile relationship with the world in which they live. But it's also a timely reminder of the looming abandonment of many of them in the face of technologically advanced replacements. And Paola joins us now to tell us more. Paola, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to speak with you. Browsing through the book, and I'll, there's the sounds of the pages. The first thing that strikes me is the sheer scale of the undertaking. This is documentary photography, I don't know what you'd call it, to a crazy level. Tell us a bit about the just the logistical undertaking. Yeah. How long did it take you to take this huge range of pictures?
A little bit over a year. That was to put the book together and do all the photographs and travel all around the world. The first idea came like 2.5 years ago, and I was doing some photos here in London, and from there, then I got excited about making something of a global scale, and kind of like I got a bit greedy, and I wanted to photograph people from all over the world. So it's been a long project, yeah.
And tell me the hope of the book when you started out, because you know the people you feature run from tattoo artists through to young kids. And you ask them, it's a journey through 24 hours of their life, the things that they come in contact with. What was the reason for you wanting to do this book in the first place?
I was kind of intrigued by seeing a picture of what our objects say about us. And I didn't want just to do like, oh, what's in your bag or show me your favorite things. I wanted an honest x-ray of your life. And there is nothing more representative of someone than just to pick a day, any day, and say, what about you? And I was intrigued to see all the things that we need, the things we use, the things that we treasure, the ones that we hold on to, how much they say about us and how misleading they could be sometimes.
And the sense of touch, as Tom was alluding to, you know, we know that, and you mentioned this in the introduction of the book, we know that the world of, you know, technology and iPhones, it means that many of the things that we used to go and physically do and did involve, you know, flicking a book or, you know, using our hands on the phone, whatever, we can now do all of this, you know, just off the smartphone in our hands. Did that become part of the story? Did it make you realize that actually, despite all of that, we still come into contact with so many tactile experiences during the day?
Completely, completely. Like, all the ones you mentioned, like all the technological ones that are making many other products obsolete, but, you know, like fork, knives, pens, all the things like hairbrush, combs, you know, those are the future. Those things are still with us. And in 10 years' time, we're going to pick up the book and the fork and knife will look contemporary, whether, you know, all the iPhone will look completely obsolete or old by then.
Now, Paola, there are obviously some very key examples of people who lead a much more, I don't know, frugal lifestyle, much more simple. I'm open on this page in particular, which perhaps you can describe for our listeners. But were there trends? Could you start to identify, I don't know, personality traits in people who were maybe trying to divest themselves and live more simply? Did you start to work out who would be doing what?
It's kind of like, you know, there is a big trend for living with objects in the present. And there was a big tension with people trying to let go things that didn't represent them anymore, you know. And it's interesting how we keep hold on things because of what they meant. And there was a big trend to try to let those ones go, as well as those objects that you use to project yourself in the future. Mm. You know, you may have a guitar, but you can't bring it to my photo shoot because you didn't really touch it. But your dream is to play the guitar one day. And all those objects, you know, they are kind of like future facing. And also there's a tendency to let those ones go and just to live with the things that, you know, you need. But the one you open the page on, Piedad, who is a cloister nun from Madrid, I met her, I went to the convent to see her. She's been inside the convent for 28 years. And her photo simply has, you know, the abbots, and it has a Bible and her sandals and the rosary. And of course, she did touch more things, but she couldn't give them to me because she saw that they were too sacred. And I was kind of quite shocked that these are the things, you know, the rosary and the Bible. I thought that they were the things that she wasn't going to give me.
Well, people talk about beautiful simplicity, and it's certainly pretty amazing. Just to pick up what you said about you didn't really touch it, you know, how do you sort of vet and make sure that people are, I don't know, being honest with you? How do you get that real? How do you capture that, the reality?
Yeah, I'm quite a police forensics investigator when it comes to this. And
I with people's underpants and things like that.
Yes, I've got everything. And I'm a trend forecaster and researcher. I've worked on research all my life, doing ethnographic research, traveling around the world, seeing how people use stuff. So if you start to talk me through your objects, I will realize that, oh, but if you did that, you should have touched that. Or why did you touch that? So I kind of like inquire a lot of things about it. at the same time, you know, if you're a participant, you are telling a story, and I want to let you tell your story as well.
I also like the one for Mole, who's a special effects artist, because he's got like a really big fat suit in the middle of his page. He touches a lot of very, very, very unusual things during the day. Lots of kind of masks and wigs and prosthetics and all sorts of things.
Yes, he has a torso eaten by a jaguar there on the right.
I've mislaid my one of those.
And he also has an oversized sneaker bar, which is a prototype that he made for an advert. So, yeah.
Do you feel that if we did this in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, it would be an interesting thing to repeat almost, to see, as you say, how our cultural lives change, how the stuff that surrounds us does alter? Because I wonder, as you say, maybe it won't change as much as you think. Maybe many of these things are kind of slightly timeless. Or do you think that we would see a dramatic change, as we said, because this kind of hint that technology is about to alter everything?
I think it's regarding categories, certain categories of objects that we may no longer see again. Something quite interesting in the book is like, I don't see music anywhere. So I don't get to know the music taste of any of the persons that are the people that are featured in the book, because nobody touches music anymore.
And what about, you know, books and magazines?
Books, more prominent. Yeah, books, you still see books. And it's hard to tell what people are doing. Like, if I go to see your, you know, bedtime routine a few years ago, I would have seen a remote control and I would have gathered, or you watch telly before bed. Now I will see a laptop.
I don't think you want to see Tom Edwards' bedtime routine, I tell you.
Yeah.
This is not for public consumption, surely.
Yeah.
Let's move swiftly on. Yeah. What about then the most surprising? I mean, we've already said the sort of torso torn apart by a jaguar. I'm guessing that's quite high on the list of surprises. Were there times when you were genuinely, I don't know, surprised or even shocked by things that people presented for you?
Yes, I mean, it's kind of like you get to see people's intimacies, you know, and they share with you, I don't know, like a little note that they wrote to themselves that means something, and, you know, they're honest enough to bring that note to you. I don't know.
Did you feel a sense of responsibility then, almost? I wonder, because you're getting that look at, you know, these very intimate workings of people's lives. Do you feel it's something you need to handle delicately, diplomatically, almost?
In a way, you know, I'm writing about people and I want to write about them and make it, you know, and they are giving me an honest day of their lives, and I want to write an honest comment about them. But with most of them, what I know about them is through the objects they touch. So the objects help me getting to know them. So
one of the other interesting things is, and not in any kind of judgmental sense, but it's interesting how many things kids touch in a day. You know, their possessions and their world, the world of stuff that they can play with, is rich and varied and complex, but it's a lot of stuff. Did that kind of shock you when you saw how many things kids had access to?
It did. And also kind of make me wonder, you know, they don't have an understanding of semantics yet. So for them, everything is an it, it's a thing. And if you look at Anna, the two-year-old girl from Tokyo, she plays with medicines and pots in the same way that she plays with Lego, you know. And we know that it's Lego. She doesn't know that it's Lego. And, you know, she can be playing with Tupperwares and piling them one on top of the other one. And it's nice to see that fresh view, you know, that fresh outlook into objects. And, you know, it's not necessarily things that are primary colors. It's anything that feels appealing.
Paola, there's a sort of fun game, and I guess it's inevitable that people who read the book properly will do, which is to turn the pages and try and work out who they're looking at. Some are a little more easy. You can certainly maybe get the age profile. Some, I've got a page here, there's a lot of fruit and vegetables, fish, ingredients. No prizes for guessing yet. It's a rabbit.
Let me see if you can guess that one.
But I wonder, is that almost part of the fun of this, is trying to jump to conclusions, even if they're completely wrong?
Yes, I wanted to give people the freedom to pick up a page and make their own mind. That's why the book is ordered, all the people are ordered alphabetically. So there is no filter or categories into who is who. So you can just go page by page and then guess about nationality, age, what they do. You got here, I think it's...
I think I might be tested now. Could be a quiz question coming up. So let's try this test then. Well, we've got a lot of fabrics. Is this a sort of geisha type? Mm-hmm. Is that? Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
I like it's a geisha, but the geisha has an Airbook Mac as well.
Well, yeah, you need to. It could be your research. You've got to keep your business affairs in order. Should we test Andrew out with one?
Yeah,
I think that's okay. This is a good game.
The interesting about this one is a male geisha.
Ah.
And he's the only male geisha in Tokyo, and he inherited his mother's business. Oh. So it's nice to see the transformation throughout the day.
It's my turn to see if I can pass the test. I wonder, we should do our own ones, Tom, as well. Let's see all the things we touch during a day.
I don't know. Mine would just
11
be,
coffee cups.
Mine would just be my desk, Andrew, because I'm chained to my desk, as you know, here at Monaco.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm hoping...
Oh, this is highly colourful, just to help the listeners out.
An Elton John impersonator, maybe? That could be. Or a showgirl. Is it they're quite big shoes. It could be a guy who likes a good wig.
Yep.
Or a wrestler. A guy is okay, is it?
Age? Can you guess age?
I'm thinking a little bit older, actually, because some of those shoes have been around the block a few times. So let's say someone... Oh, my God.
How did you do?
This is Vivian, drag artist and drag queen. Artist and drag queen, rather. And she loves to have a few feathers in her hair. Don't we all?
From Tokyo, 69.
From Tokyo?
Yeah.
Got amazing. A bit worryingly similar to my wardrobe. I'm joking, dear listeners.
No, Vivian was an amazing artist from Tokyo who participated in the project in a form of conceptual art, according to her.
Brilliant. Well, it really is an amazing book. Paola, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That's Paola Zuccotti, and her book is called Everything We Touch, a 24-hour inventory of our lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys.
Tom, a very nice show. And what I always like is when you think a topic is going to be, I was a bit kind of, a book about kind of computer games. I know nothing. I did say to him, the last time I played a computer game, I think it was Sonic the Hedgehog, and he said, the Citizen Kane of computer
that's
games.
Right, yeah.
I liked him immediately.
Yeah, and we talked a bit about the first computer ever, which I had, which was an Amiga 500 in some of the games. I couldn't remember the names, but what's interesting about that is it's not, I don't know, it does feel like a genuinely untold story. I think that's why that book has... You know, it's so timely because it feels like there's something quite significant that happened culturally. You talked about how the developments there in software and hardware affected, you know, music and the arts and computer games all equally. It's sort of the untold story. I guess it's relatively recent history. So
yeah, and I think Darren's was also interesting because I guess that's, you know, the story of, you know, the actual, as you say, the hardware industry. When you think about you know, the likes of an Apple or something, it did all begin with people like that in their bedrooms, in their garages, this kind of very kind of basic industry that then kind of grew into, you know, multi-billion dollar industry. So anyway, I liked him, and that book is a fine
it's
thing.
It's a beautiful thing, yeah.
But let's thank the producers of the show today. That was Mr. Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monaco Weekly will be back at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.